in the
Betuzumab for this purpose.
Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning.
Good morning. House Committee on Revenue is open for our hearings this morning. I want to note that Representative Bentz is on the telephone, so he may interrupt at times because he can't show us a raised hand. Welcome all this morning to our hearing. Our first item of business is the release of the September economic and revenue forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Haas and Chairman Barnhart, for having us. My name is Mark McMullen. I'm the state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, joined as always by my colleague Josh Lehner. So the economic and revenue outlook is relatively uneventful this time, which is a good thing. No news is typically good news, but and particularly from the Oregon perspective. From the Oregon perspective, our revenues are coming in a little bit faster than we expected, and our economic data still is holding up, looking pretty healthy across the board and strong. Unfortunately, things aren't looking so strong and healthy in the U.S. as a whole, and we're starting to see some starting to have some concerns in terms of the economic data in the U.S. and seeing some spreading weakness across several other states. In particular, there are four things that are bothering us the most when we look at the U.S. data. One is we're seeing personal income slow, growth slow across the U.S. Pretty rapidly at this point, which, of course, as an income tax state, is particularly important to us. And we're also seeing weakness in manufacturing that we've been talking about for some time. We're seeing that spread. It seems not getting worse, but we're seeing it spread across more industries, not just being concentrated in energy production sort of things anymore. So that, of course, being a manufacturing center, that's a concern for us as well. And also, there's really flat investment spending, business investment spending in the U.S. It's been flat for some time. And that's of particular concern because one of the things that has been characterizing this U.S. Recovery has been it's been disappointing productivity growth. And productivity growth often is led by investment. One surefire way to increase productivity is to invest in capital and to create, you know, that creates better well-being for our workers as well. And finally, the last piece of concern is state revenues. And our counterparts in other states are starting to miss their forecasts. Sales tax states, for the most part, are seeing slower growth. And even some of our income tax states that are most like us in terms of their revenue trends are starting to see the withholding out of the wages and salaries slow. So there are some you know, areas of concern out there, at least at the U.S. numbers. But again, so far, so good in Oregon. So it does need to be put in perspective. That it was put in perspective for me a couple weeks ago at our advisory meetings when I was explaining these areas of concern and discussing them with the group. And at that time, my two predecessors, Tom Petoskey and Dr. Warner, were there, and they brought me back down to earth. I was telling them how scary it was, and they said, well, you know, with all due respect, son, you don't know what scary is. Which is true. And so right now, they're right. It's hard to be scared when Oregon's job market continues to perform like it has. In the real-time data we got again yesterday, another big job number. We're growing twice as fast as the U.S., and it's, you know, across a wide range of industries. And for the most part, it seems to not slow down yet. Now, we'll talk a little bit later that it has to. It's really unsustainable right now how fast we're growing. We're adding about twice as many jobs as we are workers. And so at some point, this has to balance out, which is natural in at this point in the business cycle. So, like I say, Oregon's numbers, at least to date, are wonderful. And it's not just jobs; it's the income numbers as well, and the wages, and our revenue numbers, and the like. Pretty much across the board strength. But in the U.S., that's not true. I mentioned that U.S. personal income growth is slowing. It's gone from the beginning of 2015 at 6% year-over-year rates, and now it's been cut in half over the last year and a half in the U.S. as a whole. This is both wages and non-wage forms of income. And so, like I say, given that Oregon is traditionally very much synchronized with the U.S. Business cycle and that our revenues are very much tied to personal income, this is something we're watching very closely. This is the same numbers, but superimposed with the Oregon figures. And you see here over the last few months, this slowing really hasn't been seen here, unlike what the experience of other states. But this might just be a function of data issues. The real-time data for both the employment numbers and the income numbers tend to get revised a lot, both at the state and the U.S. level. So it may well be that when we look back at this 2 years from now, you won't see this divergence. And this happens a lot. We get this question in this group a lot about, don't Oregon's business cycles tend to lag or tend to lead the U.S.? And we always answer, well, no. As you see here, pretty much just about the same time as the U.S., all the wiggles. And it's certainly true when you add more recessions. But that perception doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from the real-time data. In the real-time data, that's what seems to happen to us, is that we do lag or lead because we don't see it right away. When we look back at the revised and cleaned-up data, it all makes sense. But in the real-time, no. In fact, with this last recession, originally the peak of employment as we were heading into the Great Recession was put in the spring of 2008. And now since then, they've revised it back, and now it's at December 2007, just like the rest of the U.S. Our growth is now. And we've had experiences like this before, and heading into the 2001 recession. It was the close of session forecast, the legislature was in session, and our office had to put out the outlook to set the budget and the kicker law. Well, at that time, the employment data had said we were slowing down, but we had continued to see job gains month after month. In hindsight, we now know that at that time we had been losing jobs for six consecutive months. But with the real-time data working with, that wasn't there. So just because we haven't seen anything in Oregon yet doesn't mean we're out of the woods. But the fact that all of the Oregon numbers are good, not just the income numbers or the job numbers or the revenue numbers, but across the board, gives us some confidence that this is a real thing. And the other thing that gives us confidence is that it's not just an Oregon issue. It's really the Pacific Northwest region. I say, sales tax states are slowing. Well, not Washington State, and the like. So it is probably true that we are still outperforming by quite a bit at this point. But the income is certainly a storm cloud, as is the manufacturing activity that Josh will talk a little bit about now.
This is a little bit of a members of the committee, Senator Haas, Senator or Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. This is just a quick update on a graph we've shown you before. It's a little convoluted, but what we're talking about is industrial production. How much stuff are the manufacturing and the mining industry producing nationwide? That's the red line. Year over year, are you going up? Are you going down? And when we first brought this to you 6-9 months ago, the red line was in recessionary territory. The declines we were seeing in industrial production nationwide are only the types of declines seen during recessions at the U.S. level. Not a leading indicator, but the fact that we are down 2% over the year has only happened during a recession. But obviously, we haven't been in recession for the last year. A lot of this weakness was concentrated in the mining industry, the oil and gas states, as the energy bust hit North Dakota and Texas and Louisiana and Oklahoma and the like. It was very concentrated. And so that's what the blue bar shows, the number of sectors within manufacturing that are contracting. How many of these 20 different industries are showing losses? And at the time, we're only seeing 5, 6, 7 of these industries were contracting. So it was a very localized, very concentrated decline. What's happened since then in the last 6 months is the overall industrial production numbers, the manufacturing numbers at the U.S. level, have actually started to firm a little bit. They've gotten a little bit better. The last couple months have actually shown increases. As Mark was talking about, real-time data. It's a little too soon to know whether this is a permanent trend, whether this data will get revised in the future. We're not entirely sure where that'll go. But what we have seen is this weakness, these declines, have spread to more industries. We're now up to 11 or 12 subsectors within manufacturing that are showing declines. So we're kind of getting this mixed signal of top-line manufacturing data is starting to look better, but the weakness is spreading to more industries. And how you reconcile that is these newly contracting industries are small. We're talking plastics, we're talking furniture makers, things like that. Some of these, they're not very big nationally or here in Oregon, but the weakness is spreading, which is a cause for concern. So now we're kind of halfway in between this land where it's a very concentrated losses within oil and gas and mining related industries and the broad-based slowdown recessionary numbers you see when things go south across the board, right? And what makes a recession is when everything goes down together. And right now we're kind of somewhere in between this. And so that's a cause for concern and certainly something worth monitoring moving forward.
Yeah, and in addition to industrial production, like I mentioned, we've had really weak business investment. But what at the U.S. level has been offsetting that has been the irrepressible American consumer. The one thing that encourages us that we won't turn into a slow growth Japan type scenario as the Americans age is this spending, and this has really done a lot to hold up the U.S. overall U.S. expansion. And there are two things that are great for the consumer is that they're both getting more income, and a lot of you have seen the most recent census numbers that came out with an increase in median income at the U.S. level that was trumpeted over the last week. We'll get the Oregon numbers here in a couple months probably and to see we expect the same sort of thing happening here. So of course income growth is good and the lower energy costs have been good that over the past year. And so we've seen quite a bit of increase on spending across the board. And one encouraging thing about the spending has been it's come without much of a decrease in savings rate. It's really coming out of the money that's the new income and the money that's freed up from lower gasoline prices and the like. So at the U.S. level, savings rates have come down a little bit for all different levels of income at the U.S., but they still are much higher than they were heading into the recession. So it's encouraging that spending is going on. Now, the support that the consumer spending has been giving us is going to start to fade now. Energy prices have been low for quite some time, and a lot of the pent-up demand that consumers have been satisfied. The auto sales at 18 million units a year is pretty extraordinary, and the thinking that these rates of growth won't continue going forward. But nevertheless, spending is healthy and encouraging. So even with these signs of trouble, for the most part, economic forecasters aren't too worried yet about the near term. Here we look at the percent, the Wall Street Journal survey of the probability of U.S. going into a recession over the next year. And it has gone up here over the past year, but we're still at 20%. It's still relatively mild compared to past history. We only go back to 2011 here, but a 20% risk of recession is not saying that much. So right now, for the most part, people aren't worried. And one thing that a lot of analysts talk about is that, well, we don't have a whole lot of imbalances in the economy. The last couple of recessions have really been characterized by big imbalances, either overinvestment or too much money going into the tech sector or the stock market or too much money going into funny mortgage assets and the like in the last one. And so people are looking for these imbalances when they're trying to, assess the risk of recession going forward. I'm not sure that's appropriate. Imbalances themselves do worsen the severity of recessions, and often they are what leads to the event that leads to the coordinating the pessimism that it takes for a recession to create, because that's really what a recession is. It's this coordinated pessimism. It's the auto company and the car dealer say, oh, well, geez, I'm worried about my sales this year, so I better not hire those workers. On the other hand, the worker saying, I'm worried about my job this year, so I better not buy a car. And when those two things happen, that's when you get the self-fulfilling prophecy and we start to circle down the drain. So that pessimism can happen with or without an imbalances. And these imbalances, even as big as the mortgage market is, you know, in terms of an accounting perspective, couldn't really derail the U.S. economy on their own. Just if you subtracted that amount of money from the economy, it would slow growth, but typically wouldn't create the sort of recessionary events that we see. Instead, it takes this pessimism, which could be coordinated by other events as well. So we're not out of the woods. We have quite a bit of uncertainty. Investors right now are fixated on the presidential election in November and the like, and so it is possible that we could become suddenly pessimistic altogether without necessarily having some bubble out there that's identifiable. But with or without a recession, Oregon kind of needs to transition down into more sustainable rates of growth. Typically, this happens with a recession, and it's a painful transition and a fast one. But it's also possible that we could just slow down as well, a more gradual glide path, which is really the character of what we have in the outlook. But as you see here, this is just looking at our actual monthly job gains relative to how big the number of potential workers is as population grows and labor force participation changes. The workforce is growing in Oregon, but not as fast as the jobs, which is typical when we're in the midst of an expansion, and particularly in the early stages of expansion. But at some point, this does have to come back down to earth, and we expect it to do so over this coming biennium, which puts the lid on our revenue growth going forward. So one important, when we try to calculate, you know, well, how many jobs do we need to keep up with population growth, one factor we can't ignore right now is the aging of the baby boom population cohort and entering their retirement years. And Josh will talk a little bit about that.
So the calculation we're making for the keeping up with population growth is looking at the changing demographics in the workplace, in the Oregon economy, how many young people, how many mid-career folks, and how many retiring folks do we have, what types of employment rates and labor force participation rates do we see among these different age groups, and then we kind of age the population through this lens, and what you see is that obviously the baby boomers are hitting their retirement years. The early edge of them have been over 65 for a few years now. Kind of the peak cohort in Oregon of baby boomers is late 50s to very early 60s, kind of 57 to 61, somewhere in there. That's kind of the largest set of baby boomers in the state of Oregon today. And they're going to be hitting the retirement years over the 10-year forecast horizon that our office is tasked with. And so what we're doing here is we're kind of looking at the changing workforce behavior and demographics for these baby boomers in the chart here. And so what it shows is we're using an arbitrary cutoff point of age 60 to get some of those early retirees in the door and what have you. But in the last 10 years, we're getting 25,000-30,000 people hitting this magical age of 60 every single year. And over the next 10 years, we're expecting the same number of folks to be hitting that 60-year-old threshold. What you can see is different is we're going to see a significantly larger increase in those that are going to be dropping out of the labor force and due to retirement. You can see the dark bars are above the light bars for the other two categories. And this is really all about the baby boomers starting to hit their mid-60s and their 70s and what have you, where the labor force participation rates and the employment rates drop considerably. By the time you're about 67, 69 years old, more than three-quarters, 80% of folks are out of the labor force entirely. They're retired. Hopefully that's for good reasons. Hopefully there's a large enough financial nest egg to support the retirement and all those things. But regardless of that, the vast majority of folks are retiring. And so this right here, this demographic aging of the baby boomers, is going to work out to something like 800 jobs a month in the next decade. We're going to need to have 800 jobs a month in the next decade just to replace the retiring baby boomers, right? So we're going to need 2,000, 2,500 jobs total to account for the increase in the working age population. About a third of that is going to be due to the retirements of the baby boomers into their out of their working years. So this is just one of the components that we're looking at when we're talking about the demographics and the keeping up with population growth. A little bit more of a pressing concern today is the tight labor market, right? The Oregon economy, we've been adding those 5,000 jobs a month for the last couple years. We're eating up the economic slack. How much slack remains in the economy is a hard question to answer. There's not a good calculation for it. It's more of a sort of a soft measure, but we go about estimating in a couple of different ways. The one you see in front of you is how many unemployed Oregonians are there per job opening. And we know, and that's what the light blue line shows. Right now, there's two unemployed folks for every single job opening in the state of Oregon. This is about as tight of a labor market as you get. The pool of candidates from which businesses can hire, at least readily hire them off the street for a job, is roughly about as small as you tend to get. We also know labor force participation has been low in recent years. It's been lower than demographics alone would suggest. So even if we added back in all these people that have given up looking for work, or they went back to school and they're going to graduate and they'll need a job in the near future, even if we add all these folks back in, we're at a 3-to-1 ratio, which is considerably lower than what we saw during the Great Recession, right, when there's 10, 11 folks per job opening. So the labor market, by all indications, is getting tight. So what does this mean? This is great news for workers. It bids up wages, right? If businesses want to hire, they want to invest, they want to expand, they need more people to do so for most businesses. When the pool of candidates is much smaller to choose from, that means the candidates can be more choosy. The firms can't be as choosy as they were during the recession, and so prices get bid up. You either have to outbid somebody for workers or you poach them from a competitor and what have you. So it's great news for workers. What it means for businesses, they also have to widen their net for searching. They have to cast a wider net to find workers, and they also have to take larger chances on individuals that maybe don't have the perfect skills or the perfect training or the perfect resume. And that's one of the things you see in the Employment Department's survey of Oregon businesses about what jobs are difficult to fill. It's not so much that they don't get any applicants. It's that they're complaining they're saying that the applicant pool doesn't have the skills I'm looking for. And so what we've seen in the last couple decades is firms not training employees as much as they used to. But now that the labor market is tight, firms are going to have to branch out, take a greater chance or a risk on somebody that doesn't have those perfect skills, and then train them up on the job to match it. And so the biggest benefit of this will also be to pull in some of these discouraged workers back into the workforce, which is something we're talking about when it comes to folks that have been displaced in the labor market in recent decades, right? This is our great Make America Great Again chart in terms of what's going on in the labor market in recent decades. Is people with college degrees, of course, have had the best labor market outcomes, higher job percentage, higher wages, and the like. What we're seeing is a combination of folks with less educational attainment. They're seeing lower employment rates. They're seeing lower participation rates and lower wages, right? And a lot of the causation seems to run from a lackluster demand for middle-skilled and middle-wage jobs, leading to this large dropout of folks from the labor market. And what you see in front of you is the decline for men in manufacturing without a college degree is basically the same as what we've seen for the decline in women in an administrative or support occupation job without a college degree, right? When we talk about the loss of middle-wage jobs and the deteriorating labor market for these folks, we tend to focus on the blue-collar manufacturing, transportation, construction jobs that have impacted the economy in recent decades. But it's not just a blue-collar male occupation story. It's impacting women to the same degree, and you can see it here with the office support staff. Again, about 1 in 5 women in Oregon without a college degree worked as an office support specialist in the 1980s, about the same proportion as men in the 1970s in manufacturing. Today, employment rates are half of what they were. And this is due to globalization, technological change, changing workplace practices. These are things that are long-run trends in the economy that are hard to replace. When it comes to production, we talk about offshoring and shipping jobs overseas and what have you. But when it comes to the office support specialist, software, Expedia.com, these sort of things mean an office support specialist can support multiple managers in multiple positions with ease today, unlike a generation or two ago. And so just the change in these types of jobs means there's less opportunity. Now that we're in a tight labor market, again, firms are going to cast a wider net to try and fill some of these positions. The hope is some of these people that are on the sidelines today, because maybe there is a little bit of a skills mismatch or what have you, will be pulled back in. We've seen an increase in labor force participation rate in the last 18 months or so. Not all of these folks that have been displaced are going to come back in, maybe not even most, but some are, and that's still good news. And this is the type of things you see in a tight labor market, where we get increasing labor force, we get increasing wages, and the like.
Okay, excuse me, before you go on, this is a slide that's puzzling to me, and it might be to other people too. I think what you're saying, and please help me understand, that in these particular kinds of occupations, we've got less than 10% of the men in these categories employed in these occupations. Presumably, some of the men with these qualifications are employed in some other category. Is that right, or do I misunderstand that?
Chair Barnhart, you're absolutely right.
Okay. All right.
I will add to that.
So we don't have a 90% unemployment rate for this group.
No. I will say that these are used as examples of the trends.
Okay.
So this is representative of what we're seeing. So if you do the math and if we talk about the decline in middle-wage jobs for folks without a college degree, on the male side, among the decline in middle-wage jobs, we've seen a corresponding almost one-for-one increase in people that have dropped out of the labor force entirely. Only a small percentage of them find a high-wage job or a low-wage job or another middle-wage job, right? 70% of the decline in middle-wage jobs in Oregon is corresponded with an increase in labor force participation rate. On the women's side, it's 90%, right? So the loss of these middle-wage jobs for men and women, the vast majority of the response is to drop out entirely. They don't find a low-wage job or they don't find a high-wage job. That's a small share. The biggest response is to just look for a job for a while, right, and find out that there's not really one available that pays a wage or in a geographic location or some sort of mismatch in there, and the response is to drop out entirely. And so these occupations are sort of just examples of the trends we're seeing across the board. That was it, and I didn't lead with the clarification of that, but I appreciate the question. Thank you.
Yeah, so when we do this accounting exercise, the math on the labor force growth and what our potential employment gains are, it gives us a real good sense of where we're going to end up in the medium term. As you see here, as we get out a couple of years, we're looking at growth rates, trend growth rates of somewhere around 1% of employment growth. So we feel pretty confident in that, that medium-term outlook and where we're going to land eventually. The problem with our models is they don't do a very good job with turning points and how we're going to get to that trend level from now. And as you see here, we are now betting that this slowdown is going to happen soon. Some of the storm clouds of the U.S. Numbers, we've pulled back a little bit of our employment growth in the near term. And so the upshot is it looks like we're going to transition down starting now and through the next biennium and a half or so in order to get down to this this sustainable rate or certainly throughout the next budget period. So with that, it does pull down the medium term in our revenue outlook a little bit. But again, this is where the uncertainty is, and it's very difficult given the timing of the budget cycle, that we're just heading into this budget period, and the timing of when we expect the slowdown to occur has real implications for revenues. And so there's even more uncertainty than there normally is at this point.
Representative Helm has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got statistics here going back to 1960 and charting the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I've been reading some recent research that takes the theory that the higher growth rates that we experienced in the 60s and 70s in particular were a result of emerging technologies at the time. And we've used up that capacity largely in terms of innovation, even though we're innovating in other areas quite dramatically. But these folks are theorizing that those levels of high growth will never occur again. And so when we look at charts like this, I think we tend to look back to the good old days and say, oh, wait, you know, we had 8% at one time. Is it realistic for us to assume that we could trend as a country or a state economically up toward those high rates of growth again in the foreseeable future? Or should we really be planning on a lower growth scenario over time?
Representative Helen, Chair Barnhart, Chair Haas, it's going to be tough. Like you say, it's productivity growth has slowed. And a lot of times that's connected with how hard we look for technologically enhancing improvements. How much are we spending on R&D, and how much are we looking for the next killer app or great thing down the road? So that's a challenge. And in the recent last couple of years, productivity growth has been particularly slow. But that said, that might not be damning forever. Economists believed up until the 90s that we were in a permanently slower productivity growth until the early 2000s and the tech boom. We all of a sudden picked up for a short period of time, and after, which surprised a lot of folks who had written their thesis about these long-term productivity slowdowns. So there's hope, but right now productivity growth is slow, and that is part of why you see over time the expansion growth rate slowing down. But there's another piece, and that's what we're talking about in terms of the labor force and the potential labor force growth, and that's usually what I highlight with this chart. In the 60s and 70s and 80s, when we were growing at, or 60s and 70s, when we were growing at 4, 5, 6% a year in employment during the expansions, we had wonderful labor force dynamics at that time. Not only were a lot of people moving to Oregon and a lot of workers moving to Oregon, but we were also seeing a lot of new workers enter the labor force. In particular, women and minorities were participating at rates at higher and higher rates. And so this added a lot of fuel to our potential job gains. And then as we headed into the 80s and 90s, we were still seeing a lot of population growth in Oregon, but these participation gains started to top out and slow down. And so there we're looking at, you know, 3-4% growth rates in the typical expansion. Now, unfortunately, the participation has turned into a headwind, in particular with the retiring baby boom population cohort. And these aren't just any workers. They're very productive workers with a lifetime of experience. And as we replace them with someone lower on the experience ladder, that has productivity implications as well. And so with those two things, the labor force dynamics and slower productivity growth, yes, I would be very surprised to see a business cycle like we had in the 60s or 70s and that kind of growth rates again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Woodson.
Thank you. So looking at your declines or your drop-offs, they're typically extreme, but in this last one, you have a very broad decline from the January 20. If you look at everything else, it just drops off every single time, and then all of a sudden you've just got this thing that's really broad. What are you thinking? Why do you think that's different than the last 40 years or 50 years?
Yeah, Representative Witness, Chair Haas, Chair Barnhart. You're right. This doesn't pass the eyeball test. And that's unfortunately the character of the economic models we use. We cannot, unfortunately, we know there will be a recession. The question is when. And it's all about timing. In terms of having the most accurate economic or revenue forecast, the best way to destroy that accuracy is to try to pick, okay, on November 13th in 2019, that's going to be when we start the recession. You know, to do that and say, okay, that's the date, that's a surefire way of getting a very large forecast error, because these turning points are so hard for our models to catch. That's why we try to supplement these with other, instead of just our econometric models, we look at things like leading indicators and tea leaves and try to do all we can and talk to business people and try to come up with, you know, to supplement the models to try to figure out when we're actually going into this recession. So, no, we can't predict one in advance. And, in fact, I won't be the first one to call it when there is a recession, given the nature of this, right? Unlike academic economists or someone, you know, on Wall Street who might want to make a name by being the first to call it, You know, for us, there's, you know, a $2 billion price tag to that. And so we are going to wait. And if, but right now, to tell you the truth, there is no chatter out there. There aren't a bunch of economists out there trying to make a name saying Chicken Little stories and the end is near. And when there is chatter like that, I'll certainly bring that to this committee's attention, because that will happen long before we're ready to swallow the budget pill that would entail. So we'll wait until we see the whites of the recession's eyes before we actually put it in the baseline outlook.
I had one last question. So on the types of jobs, did you break it out into what's government jobs and what's private sector jobs in your job growth for Oregon? Because that's a pretty big deal, actually. Are we growing because the government is infusing all of this money into the economy, or is our private sector growing and creating jobs?
Is Representative Whitsitt, Chair Haas, and Barnhart. Really, the private sector has been doing the heavy lifting. Josh has actually been looking at the details of this and the breakdown. I'll let him talk about the growth rates.
Right now, the public sector employment in Oregon is somewhere around 17% of all jobs, right? So the vast majority of the job growth is private sector. Great. And it continues to be so. What changes, the biggest changes here are the different points in the business cycle, right? Public sector is generally more stable over time and sometimes doesn't decline during recessions. This one, we saw some government losses in 2011 or 12, right? So not in 2009 when the bottom fell out of the economy, but when sort of the public sector revenues got caught up with the reality of the economy, we saw a lot of losses, and they were mostly K-12 teachers. Now that's started to reverse. Public sector budgets are back. Property taxes are growing again. Schools are hiring more teachers, right? So the public sector is at an all-time high today in the state of Oregon, a couple percentage points above where it was in 2007, 2008. The private sector in Oregon is 6, 7, 8% higher than it was back then, right? So the private sector is much more volatile over the business cycle and overall accounts for the vast majority of the job gains. That's the dynamics there between public and private change a little bit between the urban centers and the rural areas. Not necessarily so much because rural areas have a ton of public sector jobs. It's because the private sector tends to be a little bit smaller, and so therefore the public share is larger.
Okay, one more follow-up. So in the private sector jobs, how many of those are health-related jobs that are receiving money from the public sector, even though they're going into private entities, hospitals, healthcare, but the money is coming from the federal and state government for payment?
There's no question that healthcare employment has been growing at above average rates for quite some time. It slowed down a little bit in the last few years to something more along the typical industry, but we've added a ton of health jobs. And that is one that has a big geographic footprint, not just urban jobs, but they're also more rural jobs. I want to say it's close to 10% of the statewide jobs are in healthcare, roughly, and that has been increasing over time. I don't know in terms of the dollars and the expenditures what share of that is public money versus private money, but it's certainly, it's been growing everywhere, right?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Representative Whitsitt, one other place to look, we recently reclassified our home health care workers into the government, folks that are predominantly just paid through the federal money for, these aren't high-wage jobs, but the end-of-life care and home health care stuff has now actually been categorized as public employment. So for the revenues, like I say, so far so good in Oregon. Here is our withholding numbers, which is the money, income taxes taken out of people's paychecks, predominantly. There's bonuses and things in here as well, but traditionally this is dominated by wages, and things are still looking good. We just ended fiscal year 2016. Over that year, we had 8% year over year withholding growth, which just puts us in the high flyers across states. It's still one of the strongest out there, if not the strongest.
So these percentages are year over year?
Yes.
So if I see one that says 5, it means it's 5% better than last year?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And very, very noisy. You see, we smooth this like crazy, and we still have it look like an EKG. But but when we do smooth it like this, it tends to move slowly. The two times we see little discontinuities there were when we changed the withholding tables and told people they had to take more or less out of their paychecks. In 2007, it was determined that people were getting very big refunds, and the thinking, what economists think, is that, oh, well, people would rather hold their own money than have the government hold it because I could make interest on it or I could do something with it rather than having the government hold my money. And so with that good intention, the withholding tables were changed to get people closer to what they actually owed, but taxpayers did not like this. Taxpayers who were used to getting refunds still wanted their refund at the end of the year, and so those things were reversed in 2010. And so there are these moments of discontinuity there, but good intentions at any rate. So, but in terms of our top line, personal income taxes, not looking as good as the withholding, and there's a big reason for that. We paid out our kicker, and so this you see this pack. Peak filing season here as we go into April, May, June, and July. That's when this kicker was paid out either through lower payments at the end of the year or refund checks, bigger refund checks. Now that the kicker is worked into the standard tax process rather than being a check issued around Christmas time, this was largely expected. Netting out the kicker, our payments at the end of the year were pretty flat relative to last year, but that's good across states. That was pretty decent for this season. So now the kicker has almost all been paid out, and so it's for the most part it's behind us. We're expecting a little bit of a negative surprise as the extension filers finish up the next month or so. And some may have overpaid because they're not factoring in the kicker, but nevertheless, it's past us now. And so this shouldn't be a drag on growth any longer. What will continue to drag on growth and create some risk for the outlook is our corporate taxes. Corporate taxes are dropping very rapidly, as you see here. In the last half of year, the annual running rate has dropped by about $100 million in corporate taxes. Fortunately, this was built into the forecast. We've seen profitability across the U.S. weaken pretty markedly following the increase in the strength of the dollar. And so as we become less competitive, this has eaten the margins of multinational corporations somewhat, and we've seen this start to filter down into our corporate income taxes. But luckily enough, we had so far the decline is going along the lines of what was predicted. We felt that you see here this running rate of $650 million a year was a little bit higher than we expect the trend to be. It was somewhere in the $550 million is probably where we're going to land, given that we've had some tax law increases since the historical record here when we used to top out at $400 or $450 million running rate. And so in the outlook, we still expect some declines to occur over the next year. Over the next fiscal year, we expect the corporate taxes to continue moving down before they stabilize at a lower level, somewhere between $500 or $550 million per year, and then grow along with the economy. Of course, this would change drastically should Measure 97 be passed. Back of the envelope says these traditional corporate income taxes will be cut by about two-thirds should that pass. So not much change in terms of the forecast here. We see we are a little bit over the close of session forecast. Excluding the lottery, we're looking at just 20 or 30 million over the close of session forecast. So for now, halfway through the biennium, things are still holding up along the lines of what was expected when the budgets were drafted. We are seeing a little bit of more weakness in upcoming. Now we're starting to turn our attention to the next biennium, because here in a couple months everyone will be back in town and ready to worry about 2017-19. And for this, we are about a percentage point down from our high water mark of the end of last year and the fall, when we were a little bit more optimistic about the near-term growth. So now we have a little bit more of a slowdown in there, and we've pulled down back a little bit on 17-19. But as you know, none of this has been used for budgeting yet. The next one is the first one that really has content. That December forecast is the one that feeds into the government's recommended budget. So at that point, hopefully, thing will settled on the true number by that time. And then, of course, the May forecast is the most important of all, given that it sets the legislature's balanced budget requirement as well as the kicker law threshold. So the big, one big unknown for personal income taxes, even if we get the slowdown in the job market right, is going to be non-wage forms of income, particularly these volatile stock prices and capital gains. And there's been a whole lot of chatter out there about an upcoming crash in the market that people are worried about. Now, unfortunately, chatter about the market is a terrible indicator of what's going to happen to the stock market. They have, there've been a lot done. People do studies where they look at how many times stock market crash is mentioned in the newspapers, and we've had run-ups and scares every year now for the last five that are much higher than anything we saw heading into the actual crash in 2007. So people weren't concerned then; they were very, very concerned in 2011. And things like that. Yale University does a stock market crash sentiment index, and same results. It doesn't seem like we as business people or personal investors do a very good job of guessing when this is. But that said, it's not like these bull markets last forever. And so, again, it's about the timing of that more than anything else. And so right now, our vendor there, as you see, has a little bit of weakening this year in the stock market. But after that, it's up, 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 up along the lines of what we're seeing in nominal GDP growth. And I assume that's what's driving their model. And not real comfortable with it, but this is one of the forecasts we like to keep at arm's length, because there's not, again, it's very hard to do. So I'd rather somebody else forecast it for us. But you see, we do not have as aggressive growth in the capital gains as we do in the stock market. And part of that has to do with the fact that they're realized for tax purposes at different times, and that's earned in the market. People cash their assets in big lumps and take those taxable gains in big lumps. And in fact, after you see these two huge swings we had in the tech boom and the housing boom, those sucked some of this potential out of the market. There's a big mountain of potential gains out there, and back as we headed into the tech boom, people had average stock holding periods of 8 to 10 years. They'd had their, on average, held the stock that long, and so there was a lot of unrealized gains to be had. Now, by all accounts, that holding period has been cut in half, at least, since these two big churning events. And so given that, at any level of price increase, there's less of a mound to draw from or to potentially pull back from. So, as always, when we have a big cash in, as we did in 15 and 14 and 15, we're expecting a little hangover going forward, despite the fact that we're going to continue to see decent or at least flat this year in terms of the stock market. But that adds quite a bit of uncertainty, and that's the main wild card, particularly for this current biennium. Right now, the first fiscal year, we're halfway through, tracked exactly with our close of session forecast. What's going to happen in the next April is going to be largely determined by this. Do we have a stock market correction before December 31st, in which case it will be part of the April payments in this current biennium?
Does that indicate that the people who make these projections think that interest rates are going to continue to be very low?
Yeah, Representative Barnhart, our outlook for interest rates is starting to hike now, but in a gradual way. So by the end of this forecast period, or rather the end of the biennium, I think it tops out at 3 or 3.5% over the next 2 years. Is that the current
Yeah, it tops out in the 3% range. Probably not over 2 years, but probably a little bit longer horizon than that. But the first initial assumption is they're expecting another hike in December. Not today, but in December from the Federal Reserve. But yeah, the terminal funds rate is what they call it, where it tops out somewhere in the 3% range, which is low historically.
But it's a good point to mention. The time they did raise the quarter point a few months ago, we certainly saw a response in the stock market, and that's the conventional wisdom that this is good, you know, that this will be the coordinating event to pull the air out of the market. But again, there isn't a direct causality there, so we'll see. Okay, another wild card we have here is the lottery.
Right now, with the lottery, there's two competing trends. One is revenues continue to come in above expectations; they continue to boom in the last 18 months, and certainly in the last 8 weeks, we're seeing a slight slowdown in the rate of growth in video lottery sales across the state. However, it remains very robust, certainly relative to the last 5-6 years. That said, the wild card is the impact of the Cowlitz Tribe's new casino in La Center, Washington, that is set to go live late spring 2017, and what impact will that have on the video lottery? We brought this to your attention and talked about it more in depth 3 months ago. The only change this time is we've increased the impact of the casino a little bit, from around $100 million a year to $120 million a year in sales. That results in an increase of about $65 million in transfers to $75 million in transfers, available resources for the legislature to spend. And the reason you can kind of go about this two different ways, you can do a top-down approach. What does the overall gaming market in the Portland region look like? What share will the casino take? The other way you can do it is a bottom-up approach, where you look at individual retailers and zip codes and neighborhoods of where the actual lottery dollars are spent, and start from the ground up and look at what the impact would be in North Portland. The northern swath of the Portland metropolitan area accounts for an outsized share of lottery revenues across the state, and a lot of that we know are Washingtonians coming across the two interstate bridges. Hayden Island and the Park Rose neighborhood have a lot of lottery sales, and there's a lot of state of Washington license plates in the parking lots, because it's an easy, accessible, convenient gaming experience that's just a short drive away. We're expecting a lot of those dollars to flow up to La Center when the casino opens, as well as some other Oregonian dollars going up as well when people want to go on the weekends and game at the casino. So doing the bottom-up approach results in a slightly larger impact, but it's somewhere in the ballpark of $100, $120 million per year impact on video lottery sales. We're continuing to refine that estimate, working with the lottery on some new research projects and the like. And so as we get closer to that implementation date or the casino go live date, we'll continue to modify that estimate.
Yeah. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of this lottery dollars, how much of that goes into the general fund, and how much is dedicated to other things?
Senator Riley, Chairs Haas and Barnhart, it depends upon which game you're talking about and what the transfer rate is, how much net profit there is by game once you strip off administrative costs. Among the net transfers to the legislature, about a third is constitutionally dedicated, 18% for the Education Stability Fund, 15% for parks and wildlife and natural habitats or whatever that's officially called. And so that's a third of it. The two-thirds left, then you know, there's the addiction treatments, there's the universities, there's debt service and what have you. So that purely discretionary amount is probably also somewhere around 30-40% of what is generally spent from the legislature's perspective.
Yeah, just debt service is about $1.04, rough numbers.
Chair Barnhart, that is correct.
But this has been the one that's really bothered us this biennium in terms of our forecast errors. This is about four times larger forecast error than we've had in the general fund forecast, which is significantly larger. So this is one we're having a very hard time getting a hold of. So here, for the upshot, here is the change in revenues, general fund, and overall resources when we add the lottery in. So for the current biennium, we see really not much change at all. General fund revenues down by just a bit more than a billion would be more. But that offset by an $8 million.
Oh, here went the headline.
Increase, yeah. in our lottery fund. So this is next to nothing. There are a couple moving parts here. One, we've brought in a little more money than we expected in the last few months, so that's a positive. But at the same time, we've decided to reduce near-term employment growth a little bit, and so that's a negative. And in this fiscal year 2017, those pretty much offset each other, and so we end up with an unchanged forecast. In 17-19, and 19-21, you see the income tax losses that are associated with the slower job growth. 56.
Excuse me just a moment to make certain we understand. When you say income losses, what you're really referring to, I think, is reduction in the growth rate.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Representative Barnhart, that's absolutely accurate. The slower employment growth, so we have less growth in revenues than we expected before.
Because your earlier forecast projected significantly higher growth, and now you're saying it's going to be a little less than that.
Correct. Yes. In recent forecast rounds, our advisors have encouraged us to push out these top rates of growth. We've been growing at this full throttle rate for a while. So when are we going to start to transition down? They've been talking us into delaying that the last couple of rounds. This time, with what we're seeing at the U.S., we decided to go ahead and pull it back forward a little bit. So you're right. We are erasing some of the gains we added over the last couple. But that's a very important point, and it's one that I don't communicate as well as I should, which is the overall general fund growth. We're still expecting significant growth in that biennium. In pretty much every line item is going to grow significantly over the biennium, somewhere on the order of 10%. Most line items are going to be up 10% over, and overall resources up, almost $2 billion, in the next biennium. So there is growth in here, but less growth than was expected previously. So we see that in terms of the lower forecast for personal income tax growth there. That's the biggest chunk of those general fund revenues in the next couple of biennia. And then in the out years, we actually increased the growth rate a little bit. And so that starts to go away turns into a net positive eventually. So we've changed the pattern, a little weakness further forward, and then a little more strength out. So we've changed the timing of the business cycle more so than the trend rate. As I argued before, we feel comfortable about where we're going to land, and so pulling it forward, that we're still expecting to land in roughly the same place. We've just changed the timing here. 17-19, note that doesn't jump out of this chart is 17-19 would the general fund revenues would be weaker if not for the incorporation of the OLCC surcharge. We have difficult time with the surcharge, 50 cents on a bottle. We have difficult time working that in the forecast because it comes out of the commission and not out of the legislature. And we like to use the current law forecast. But the timing of when this becomes law is a little bit different than the stuff that's passed through the regular legislative process. And so this has been confusing in the past, so I want to make this clear. We've now gone ahead and done it for 17-19, not 19-21. This is something that the commission has been doing on an ongoing basis since they instituted the surcharge during the recession, and they've been renewing it year to year. But we don't put it in the forecast until it's been renewed. And I understand that that's the point. That's the case now. And so we've added about $35 million to the next biennium as a result of that. Okay. So the changes on net, again, this is just the same picture in a picture instead of a table. You see it's really driven by the personal income tax becoming weaker in the next couple bienniums and then going back to trend eventually. That orange bar there, that's the OLCC surcharge standing out there and for the next biennium. And so as we transition into the longer term, again, with the aging population and less job growth, we expect slower rates of growth than we've become accustomed to, somewhere around 10% every biennium. In the past, Oregon's been used to 15 or 16% in a expansion biennium, and so it's still considerably lower than that. Now, I apologize for this next convoluted one. The more I look at it, the more confusing it is. And so I'm glad I didn't do this when we have the full legislature in session. It's, we'll have to communicate better, break it down Barney style for the full group. But this one here is really trying to give a sense of, okay, so where are we in the budget process and what does this forecast what could go wrong? What's the range of expectations that you all should have for setting the budget? And so there are really two worlds we can go into 2017-19. Either we're in a world where we have a recession or a world where we don't. And it's probably there's people talking about recessionary risk. You saw the one-year recessionary risk was 20%. So call it 50-50 for the next 2-3 years, something like that, somewhere in that range. So if we don't have a recession, it's the idea is pretty simple. We have such a slow growth in our forecast and such a decline, it's hard to think that we're going to see much slower than that without a recession. And so the likely outcome if we don't have a recession is that we will get a kicker and be stuck at this somewhere around the $19.6 billion. Who knows where the closest session will land, but that's where our current estimate for the biennium is. So no matter how good it gets or how rapidly we grow, that's where we top out in terms of available general fund resources. The kicker gets bigger, and arguably so too does economic spending and activity if we have, and indirectly could improve revenues, but directly no. And so we get topped out. And we could do a little better than that. There's about $370 million between that our forecast and the 2% kicker threshold. So if we land in that sweet spot where we're right in between what we've expected and this 2% threshold, there may be another $300 to $400 million in available revenues there in the blue area in between. So what if we do have a recession? What if things aren't so hot? Right. Well, there's two real factors that determine what's going to happen to us. One is how severe that recession is, and the other would be when it starts, which is an important one. So here I put an estimate. So let's say we're talking about a severe recession like we just saw. And leaning on some work from the Legislative Revenue Office, that's a little over $2 billion potentially taken out of the biennium. But that pain gets lessened as we get closer to the end of the biennium. When does this thing start? If it starts today, that's obviously the worst pain for 17-19, but there's a silver lining. If it starts today, we may actually know about it before you guys draft the budget, and so, or at least get out in front of some of it. That's not always the case. We talked about how the real-time data sometimes fools us. So our worst case scenario would be something starting sometime around the beginning of the biennium that we don't really have a sense for yet, that we're, that we don't build it in, despite the fact that it's already occurring, a Wile E. Coyote moment, if you will, when we're still have our forecasts flying away, and then, but in actuality, the bottom's dropping out. So that's as bad as it can get. Somewhere, we'd be down to somewhere around $17.5 billion. But then, the later it gets into the biennium, the less that potential gap for this biennium that would become a 1921 event as much as it is currently. And so that's, to Representative Witsit's point, that's one way we could actually get this thing right on forecast accidentally, would be to grow, continue to grow healthy rates through much of the biennium and then have a recession. We could still end up at the same point that we have a more subtle glide path. That's another way we could get there if the recession happens late enough in the biennium. So that's what we're really looking for. So the important point is really when this thing starts and to what extent we can get out in front of it. And so that's why we're really biting our fingernails right now thinking about, as we head into this particular budget session, wanting to know whether or not a downturn is here.
And just to be clear, you're not predicting one, are you?
No, absolutely not, Representative Barnhart. We do not have one in there. I think the slowdown we have in there it makes me feel pretty brave, but I don't know if that is really the case. So no, there is no recession built in there. Again, the timing of building in a recession is very difficult, and so we're going to wait until we darn well know there's one, and then do our best to tear the Band-Aid off all at once. I know that in the past, when we've had recessions, it can be very difficult for the legislature to every quarter get another 300, 500 minus, 500 minus, over and over again, like water and torture. So we're going to try our best, as hard as it is, to say, okay, now we know the recession's here, it's a real thing, and then just rip the Band-Aid off all at once, and so that make it an easier management problem for the legislature.
Yeah, 2002 was an enormous catastrophe for the legislature, precisely because of what you just described. That we were told that we'd have a $250 million shortage, and then it was much bigger than that, and then it was bigger again all through that year. And so, I mean, that was my first term, and it was miserable.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't guarantee we won't do that again. That is our human nature, I think, a little bit, as you know, as forecasters. So we'll see, but we're going to try our best to take it out all at once if it does come to that. And if it does come to that, this $2 billion gap, at least unfortunately, the budget gap is much bigger than $2 billion because we don't have the expenditure side here. And obviously, spending needs go up with a bad economy as well. But in terms of the revenue side, we've almost got half of that packed away. We are darn near at the end of in July 2016, we are darn near counting ending balances as well, up to $1 billion in reserves, more than the state has ever had before. Again, not enough to weather a recession, but to take away, in this case, you know, half of the revenue losses, at least, if not any help on the expenditure side. So that's encouraging, and this should continue to expand going forward if our baseline holds. So with that, as always, feel free to contact us with any follow-ups in case you don't have any questions now.
Great question. Yes, Chair Hass.
Thank you. I was kind of surprised that the phrase minimum wage didn't come up in your presentation. I was just wondering if you factored in your forecast, good or bad, what this will do to revenues or jobs in coming months and years.
Yes, Senator Hass, we have built that in, and it is in the report we do have the minimum wage pulling jobs. 20,000 is where it gets at the end, right? 20,000 last year. Oh, 40,000 reduction in employment worked into the outlook as a result. As this, of course, it's phased in, so too are the job drags going forward.
Yeah. So 40,000 fewer than what would have grown, and the corresponding revenue impact is offset by higher wages and more income, or is that too specific to forecast out?
Yeah, Senator Hass, it does help. The higher wages do help in terms of the revenue loss, but there is a revenue loss. But that said, given the nature of these jobs, it's not a huge part of the economy, so it's not a huge shock on the revenues. At our current $9.50, or what it was before the law change, our typical minimum wage worker worked an average of 10 hours a week. So if you multiply 10 hours by 9 or 10, $12 an hour with that increase, it doesn't really move the needle that much in terms of these aggregate top line numbers. Where the impact of the minimum wage is going to be at the ground level, either on one single family's their resources, or on a given firm's costs, or a given industry's costs. But at the top line, this gets kind of washed out.
One additional comment on the minimum wage that I forgot to include earlier that I meant to is is with this tight labor market we're seeing now with these increases in wages, it's really impacting the low wage workers the most today. There was a Wall Street Journal article not too long ago that the lowest tier of wage earners in the nation are seeing the fastest wage gains recently because of this tight labor market, particularly in these lower income jobs across the board, across the nation. You're seeing Starbucks, or maybe not Starbucks, but Walmart and JP Morgan Chase and McDonald's and what have you increase their corporate minimum wage, right? Not sticking at the federal level to attract and retain these workers. And we're seeing that here in Oregon too. We just got back from a trip with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors to Newport last month, where we met with local businesses and community leaders and what have you, just to get a sense of what's going on in Newport. One of the things that came out of that was a restaurant owner. She was talking about that her and her colleagues, the tourism industry on the coast, were really concerned about the minimum wage law being passed, right, and what it would do to their business costs going from $9 up to $11, $12 over the next decade or next 7-8 years. But the tight labor market has already taken care of that. The effective minimum wage on the Oregon coast today is $11 an hour already because of this tight labor market. And it wasn't just coming from this. There's a giant banner outside of the Taco Bell in Newport that's saying hiring starting at $11 an hour. Right. And so this tight labor market being good for wages for workers, we're already seeing that taken into account. And so the minimum wage law maybe is not much of a binding constraint, so to speak, today. We'll see what happens with the next recession and that sort of impact. But again, the tight labor market being good for workers, we're already seeing that play out above and beyond some of the legislation as of today, at least.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. I just have sort of a question on when you're looking at recession indicators, you're talking about
exactly
nationally versus Oregon.
What are you saying, yeah.
This is just a question for you guys. Do you ever look at the shipping indices like the Baltic Dry? And we're having a really severe problem that we haven't seen for a number of years, and I guess that's related to manufacturing. I mean, I don't know, how do you go about, I mean, I read the Wall Street Journal too, and so I see we have kind of a problem with student loans, mortgages, credit card debt, and then when we're trying to predict the onset of this next recession. And I was just wondering, do you get into that at all? I mean, I know it's kind of outside of Oregon's purview, but what are your feelings on, without putting you on the spot?
No, Representative Whitsitt, we do. And these are, a lot of times use different kind of trade indicators and in our leading indicator approaches. Like I said, we do these tea leaves non-model approaches, and that's one of the things we throw in. Because every one of these potential leading indicators is noisy. Sometimes they're telling the right story, sometimes they're not. So the way we tend to deal with things like and that's usually what the shipping data is used for, is you put a bunch of them together and then see how many are red and how many are green, and is there a lot of chatter or a lot of these things turning bad or a lot of these things turning good. And with both us and the leading indicator put together by Tim Dewey at the University of Oregon do lean on some trade data. Unfortunately, we don't have as good of Oregon-specific data as they have at the national level.
Thanks. Yeah, I just wondered if you consider all of those things.
Yeah, and in general, that the trade numbers are bad right now, mm-hmm. and it's across the board. Since the dollar became stronger, we've really seen it in Oregon. It gets in Oregon, the data gets a little bit covered up by the amount of trade we do in terms of chips and technology, mm-hmm. right? Because when we're looking at the value of exports, you know, one bag of chips is as valuable as a whole whatever. Barge full of grain or whatever. So sometimes that can be a little misleading, but excluding the technology stuff that's on its own cycle and is roughly flat, we've seen all our machinery exports and the like and all that flows have been dropping pretty rapidly and are down on the order of 20% a year for most of them.
Thanks.
And that's the dollar. The strengthening of the dollar is the problem, or is it something else?
That and the weakness of the global economy. There's less demand out there, too.
Sure. Other questions for state economists? Thank you so much for your presentation today. Very much appreciate it. Please don't bring us a recession anytime soon. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Are you ready to go?
Say a couple things.
Paul, please.
Couple things for the committee. Corinne wanted me to remind you to fill out your per diem forms because this is not legislative week. So we'll handle those for you if you get them to Corinne. So I also want to introduce our intern, Jake Kern, who is over from Willamette. And we've already, Jake started with us last week. We have him looking at homestead exemptions around the country and looking at what kinds of programs different states have. So that's one of his first projects, but we have many of them planned for.
Getting ready for next week?
Yeah.
Or later?
Or later.
Or later.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Anything else?
No. We're, yeah.
Are you ready for the 9:30?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It is officially 9:30. And time for a review of our tax expenditures due to sunset Legislative Revenue Office. Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is just a quick update on tax expenditures and tax credits that are sunsetting. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. So I have three documents I was going to go through quickly. And the first one here is the, it's become kind of a standard table for the tax credits that are sunsetting and the estimated cost of extending those tax credits. So this first batch here are the tax credits that are going to be included. And I've reworked the table a little bit. I had it organized by sunset date, and I've reworked it to group them according to those that will be reviewed by the different legislatures. So in the 2017 legislature, most of the tax credits that will be reviewed are sunsetting on 1/1/18. There are a couple of exceptions. There's the Wolf tax credit and the two housing tax credits. That's the most notable one. They are not scheduled to sunset until January 1st, 2020. But in the past, advocates have argued that they need to be reviewed early because reviewing them in the year of the sunset is too late in their process. These are basically investment-related tax credits. Mm-hmm. And I guess just to step back a little bit to review for members who haven't been here during this whole process, by now the legislature has gone through all of these tax credits. We're now beginning to go through the second round. The sunsets were placed in 2009. And then the first batch was done in 2011, the second batch in 2013, and the third batch in 2015. So now we're about to go through them for the second time. Having said that, every time the process is a little bit different, and the LRO report was first required by the 2013 legislature, so only the 2015 report, that was the first one. So the upcoming one is the second one. And this is a live document, and it gets shared kind of randomly depending on interest level. And the bottom line here for 17-19, we're looking at about $25 million to extend the tax credits that are due to sunset. And that number does change, and it'll probably change again before the February session. But right now, as I'm updating the data, it's bouncing around between $25 and $30 million. So that's a ballpark figure. And of those, the largest is the residential energy tax credit. That's about $15 million of the $25 million. So that'll receive a fair amount of attention. And other ones that seem to be getting a lot of attention are the research activities tax credit, which is a corporate tax credit for R&D conducted in the state. And then the affordable housing lenders tax credit. That doesn't have much of an impact here because, again, the sunset isn't for a couple more years. You may be hearing about that one already. The biomass tax credit, this one in 2016, it was kind of split up. The manure piece of it was extended for a few years, so the cost of the extension here is a little bit less than it might have been otherwise. The largest chunk of that is woody biomass for that, the cost of that tax credit. And then, of course, the themes here, we have some energy tax credits. And just to note, the long-term rural enterprise zone tax credit is a tax credit that there are very few claimants, and there's a fairly public process. The governor has to agree to grant the tax credit. So there is some information out there in some way. So the data gets suppressed because we have a very few number of tax claimants. So this is one that we'll have to, we can't say what the revenue impact is. So we're thinking about how to communicate information on this tax credit, because I don't know that we'll be able to say exactly what the dollar amount of the revenue impact will be if there are only a couple of claimants. So that presents an awkward situation for the legislature in terms of moving forward with what we can talk about the policy and the impact and that kind of thing, but the bottom line revenue impact reflects information on tax returns, which, as the committee is aware, is confidential. The other two things down here at the bottom are two other tax expenditures that will be sunsetting during the upcoming biennium. And so it's kind of an enigma to include them on this table because these are generally just tax credits. But one here is a film production labor rebate that's due to sunset. That is the Greenlight rebate program. And those rebates that are paid are exempt from the income tax. So this is just the tax exemption for those Greenlight rebate payments. And then the other one is a property tax item. It's alternative energy systems. That's due to sunset as well during the biennium. And so we're just trying to keep a better eye on all of the tax expenditures that are scheduled for sunset in the upcoming process. The tax credits have that formal process. The others, too, the process is a little bit less formal, but I would expect there'll be bill drafts to at least extend those, or at least to present the committees with the opportunity to discuss the policies.
Mm-hmm. Now, in past years, the LRO has prepared bills for simple extensions for all the tax credit. Is that part of the plan this time as well?
I believe that
so,
is.
Just so they're available?
Right, just so they're available.
Okay.
Question?
Yo, Senator Harris.
Thank you. Chris, could you refresh us with what the residential energy tax credit is? Because I seem to remember a discussion up here about, you know, if you went out to buy a dishwasher or whatever, you couldn't buy one that didn't have one of those energy savings things, right. And there was no reason to continue this incentive. So, and I thought we didn't. So was that a different?
Chair Haas, it is a variety of tax incentives. The appliances are still there, but to focus on that, in 2011, when this credit was reviewed, that was the case, and the law was changed in 2011 to raise the bar, as it were, for the incentive. And so presumably in 2012 and 2013, you actually could go to Lowe's or Home Depot and find refrigerators that didn't get the tax credit, because it was really supposed to be the intent of the credit is to push the technology, and only at the cutting edge and at the most expensive, highest end, receive some sort of tax credit. And one policy that the legislature did put in place was it allowed the Department of Energy to modify the value of that tax credit based on market conditions. So now that we're 6 years down the road, that'll be part of the report and the analysis and communicating with the Department of Energy about how that worked, because it really was that, and that was a big piece, and that was a big piece of the revenue savings in 2011 when the tax credit was extended. But then other pieces that are included in there would be things like solar panels for a home, any other renewable energy, any other piece of energy savings equipment that would be used in the home. And that's how I tend to think about the RETC is energy savings devices used in the homes, whereas the other energy tax credits are related to businesses. And then just on the backside of this, just to point it out, these are the remaining active tax credits that would be reviewed, at least right now, as of right now, according to their sunset date, and other policy considerations would be reviewed by the 2019 legislature and the 2021 legislature. So on this document, it contains all of what I refer to as the active tax credits. And that's basically where a taxpayer can be a new claimant to a given tax credit. So that's that document, and the key thing is the revenue impact piece here that we'll be looking at. And again, this is an active document, so a key thing to be aware of is the date on this to the extent that this document gets circulated. So the next thing I wanted to move to was in producing the second tax credit report, here is just the table of contents to highlight what the report is looking like right now. So really, whatever feedback the committee would provide would be welcome. The structure is largely the same as the first one. You have the first section is just a review of overall tax expenditures to basically put the tax credits in context of all income tax expenditures. Second section is to describe the tax credit review process, which largely is similar across sessions, but there is variation from session to session. And then the meat, if you will, or so to speak, is section three for the tax credits. And right as I'm looking at this, I need to modify this because it's not pure. There are a couple of the 2020 sunset ones in here, but for the most part, it's the 2018. And to bring these up to some sort of theme, we have four tax credits that are related to economic development, three enterprise zone tax credits, and the R&D tax credit. Then we have the energy tax credits, the residential or the homes, and then four others that are business related. You have the conservation, renewable energy, and transportation, the children of Betsy, as it were, and then the biomass tax credit. Then the next group, the natural resources, we have the livestock killed by wolves and the fish screening devices. Those will be included. Technically, the livestock killed by wolves already sunset because part of the sunset in the law was a given date or upon delisting, and in November of last year it was delisted, so it's already sunset. And then the last two, the housing here, or not the last two, but the next two, the housing, the low-income housing credit and the ag worker construction credit. Those are the two that actually sunset in 2020. And then the last two are the rural medical providers credit. That was one that was reviewed last time, but it was extended just for 2 years. There was another bill, House Bill 3396, that really tried to move forward in collecting information on all of the incentives, indirect and direct, on providing better medical access to rural Oregon. So we hope to feed off of that information in that report. And then the fire insurance tax credit is one that gets everybody excited because we get to talk about the retaliatory tax. And then section four is, and again, this document is kind of live and in play. It's a tax credit transferability piece. As everybody is aware, transferability is an issue for a variety of reasons. And I believe every tax credit that is transferable is in this group. So it seems appropriate to include a separate section to discuss transferability because there's still a lot of questions out there about exactly how that works and what it means and whether or not it's a viable policy. There are a lot of policy questions just related to tax credit transferability. And then the end of the report here, we just have a bibliography, kind of a standard academic thing. And then the appendices are kind of in flux. The legislative history I included last time, they're just detailed tables to show the bill history. It's for people who are particularly interested in the details. Tax credits by other states, that seemed to work well last time. That question always comes up about what other states have tax credits similar to these, and that's just put in an appendix. The policy questions, I don't know if that will stay or not this time as the process modifies. That may or may not be germane. And then the tax credit review history, again, getting back to the fact that this is our second go-round through the tax credits, there might be a piece in here that just goes over what has been done through the first round of tax credit review. And then the last piece, House Bill 3542, right now it's in here. It doesn't necessarily have to be in this report, but that was the bill that required us to look at any estimates that we produced for new tax credits, and if they were off by, I think, 10%, to highlight them and bring them to the attention of the legislature. Mm-hmm. So I don't know exactly what form this is going to take, if it's easier to do it, to limit to that list or to do a comprehensive list. But right now I have it tagged in here just so we're all aware of it and we don't lose track of it because that was a new piece of legislation.
Do you anticipate that there will be some on that list?
Nothing comes to mind immediately as being on that list.
That's nice to hear.
That's if there's nothing on the list, then there's nothing to produce. So it creates a weird situation where, okay, here's a blank piece of paper.
The report's short.
Very short.
It simply says there aren't any.
Right.
Yeah.
And that may be the case, but we'll yeah. So if there aren't any questions on that, but again, to the extent that you have any input on or any suggestions or any questions, please contact us, and we'll, because the report is being modified, and this is just a snapshot of what it looks like it'll be right now. And in talking about sunsets more generally, another provision that was passed in 2013 is a default or implicit sunset date for all tax expenditures. Everybody's familiar with the 6-year kind of automatic or default sunset date for tax credits. So if a new tax credit is created and the legislature does not specifically identify a sunset date, there is a default date of 6 years. Well, in 2013, that same policy was applied to all tax expenditures, effective for those that were enacted in 2014 and later. And so now we're getting to a place where there are a number of provisions that have been enacted, in a couple in 2014, several in 2015, and a couple in 2016, that may or may not be tax expenditures. And if they are tax expenditures, then there's a sunset date. And I refer to it as a default sunset date or an implicit sunset date, because a number of these provisions, if they are tax expenditures, have this sunset date, but you can't go to the provision in statute that identifies it and look up the sunset date. For all of the tax credits, you can go to that ORS and see language that says you can't claim that, taxpayers can't claim this after January 1st, whatever. So now you have to marry together two different pieces of law to understand the sunset date. So that's why the implicit or the default. But inherent in this discussion is almost a philosophical discussion of what is a tax expenditure. So a tax expenditure is a deviation from an established tax. And I don't want to belabor the point, but there are a lot of questions about what is an established tax. And so these are provisions, and the Department of Revenue, as they're going through creating the tax expenditure report, they're having a lot of these discussions about these provisions of law and saying, well, are these a tax expenditure or are they not? And so this list is very preliminary information, and it may change, but it really gets at to whether or not something is a tax expenditure. And where that's more relevant now is because of the sunset date. So the key things, so we can have that philosophical discussion, but the bottom line for the legislature is just to be aware of these default or implicit sunset dates so that the legislature is able to act ahead of time in whichever manner it chooses. A key piece of this is the intangibles there. We see 3 or 4 of these related to that Senate Bill 611, and there can be legitimate discussions about whether or not these are tax expenditures or is it part of the base definition of a tax. And a clear example that I've always used is some of the gas taxes, which are designed, I'm getting a little bit out of my field here, but designed to fund the roads. So farm equipment, for example, doesn't have to pay those taxes. Well, is that a tax expenditure because they're exempt from paying those taxes? Or is it part of the base because that revenue was designed to focus on the roads? And the farm equipment doesn't really use the roads, so they were never part of the base. So it's part of that discussion, and it is an academic discussion, but we're just keeping an eye on these sunset dates. The one that does pop up immediately is the interstate bridge, because that was passed in 2014. There was a retroactive piece, and so given this other law about the default sunset date, as soon as it was passed, it had already sunset, because it was passed in 2014 and it was retroactive to 2018, because it's a property tax piece that was related to an exemption for interstate bridges, and it had been accidentally or inadvertently sunsetted in 2007. It was reinstated in 2014, but that meant it also sunset immediately in 2014, because of the that provision that reinstated it beginning in 2008 didn't specify a sunset date. So it got enacted, or under some arguments, it got enacted in 2008, and therefore it sunset in 2014. So there might be a bill this session on that piece from this list, if nothing else, just to eliminate any potential confusion. But the rest of them, we're looking at sunset dates that might be in 2021 or 2022. So nothing immediate, but we do want to keep track of it so we can stay on top of it. And so those were the three pieces I had about the tax credits, the upcoming tax credit report, the cost of extending, and just the academic philosophical discussion of what is a tax expenditure.
So. I have just one.
Mm-hmm.
Does this discussion you just were describing about what's a tax expenditure and what isn't, does that have any implications based on the Seattle Light case? And the constitutional rules around revenue raising bill.
Chair Barnhart, potentially it does. I mean, we're still kind of.
Now, are there the same considerations for these two issues or not?
Well, they're
issue
different.
One issue being the automatic sunset, and the other issue being the Seattle Light.
Well, the Seattle Light has to do with the requirements for a bill for raising revenue
and
the 3/5. And to the extent these are tax expenditures, they usually deal with a base issue.
Right.
So if the idea of eliminating a tax expenditure is expanding a base, that isn't necessarily the creation of a new tax or changing a rate.
Right. That's what I was wondering about, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This brought up a question in my mind. You talk about the philosophic discussion about what is an expended tax expenditure and that this discussion is going on and someone's making a decision about which ones are which. Who is that that's making that call?
Chairs Barnhart and Haas and Senator Riley, that was referenced to the tax expenditure report, which
mm-hmm.
is it's a required document. It gets produced by the Department of Revenue with feedback from relevant state agencies. It's technically a governor's report. It's a companion to the budget. So the production of that report is housed within the Department of Revenue, and so they include all of it's supposed to be a full listing of every tax expenditure. Now, that can create some awkwardness in some of the estimates, as the committee is aware, but it kind of falls on them what is or isn't a tax expenditure and what gets included in the book. And not to speak for the department, but they've generally taken a broader view of what is a tax expenditure, so at least it gets included in the book so people can have the debate. It's easier to have the debate over something if you can point to the document and say, here it is, and I disagree with it being a tax expenditure, versus a provision not in the tax expenditure report. And so they're going through these discussions and soliciting input from wherever they can. They part of that regular process is they talk to LRO, they also talk to OEA, they talk to the governor's staff, obviously. And it really is a listing there, and they're trying to be clear about what is or isn't, but because of the sunset dates in 315037, it has this added aspect of the sunset date. Now, there isn't anything immediate there, but it's just to be aware of.
So they're asking for input on what they should be doing in this, and my input is make it as broad as possible.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator. Anything else?
Mr. Chair. Representative Benz here.
Representative Benz, please.
Let me begin by saying that none of you look deplorable. I just want to point that out.
Thank you. We're pleased with that.
So I'm concerned about this, as I guess all of us are, and I'm wondering if there is, to follow up on the senator's remarks, a white paper or a memo or something I can look at, we all can look at, to see the thinking that's going into, I think, actually a couple of issues, maybe certainly the Seattle case, but also the point you raised, Chris, and then the word enact, as used in that highlighted language, is of concern to me. It seems to me that we need to be extraordinarily careful that we understand what enact means as we enact different things. So a white paper on this so that we don't inadvertently do stuff that we don't think we're doing would be helpful.
And we've had discussions with legislative council, and we will continue to have those discussions. And for most of these, there is time to address it one way or the other. So we can put something together.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Anything else? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And you've gotten us back on schedule, which is fantastic. It is now officially 10:15, time for the review of personal income tax processing season for the Department of Revenue. Aha, he's here.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Chair Senator Haas, members of the committee. My name is Ken Ross. I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm one of the personal income tax program managers, and I've been asked to come give an update on this processing season, this past processing season, in light of the new system that we installed at the end of last year. So I didn't prepare a PowerPoint or anything, so I'm just going to go from, I got some talking points. I'm going to try to overwhelm you with numbers or bore you to start out with, and then go through some factors that influenced this season, and then I want to talk a little bit about the new system, some features it brings, and then looking forward if that works. And of course, I'll take questions at any time if that works for you. So some numbers. As of September 1st, we processed a little over 1.9 million personal income tax returns, which is about where we were at all of last year, the previous year. So it looks like we're going to hit 2 million returns this year for the first time ever. About 86% of those are e-filed, 1.7 million. This year, our number of refund returns were up. We're just under 1.5 million refund returns, which is about three quarters of the returns filed. That's about 187,000 more than the previous year, which we probably could attribute to Kicker. That'd be a good estimate or guess anyhow. And just as a side note, just over a million of those asked for a direct deposit, which means that's a million checks that we didn't have to mail out. Now I want to talk a little bit about the season itself, the processing times, and our numbers in days that it took us to process were longer this year, and I'm sure you were aware of that. You may or may not have fielded the calls from constituents or emails wondering if you could intervene on their behalf to get a refund out the door. We were overwhelmed in our own building with calls. Our call volume doubled this year. Business signals were up 100%. It was one of those, the year was different. We talk about returns and filing methods. Electronic e-file returns. We also get 2D returns and traditional paper. And the 2D is actually a paper return with a barcode on it that we can scan and essentially for processing turns it into an e-file return. We break it down further by suspended and non-suspended, and by that we mean our system is automated. It'll automatically process a tax return, and if it, we build edits and rules around the return. For example, we'll build an edit if a credit, the maximum of credit is $1,000. We build an edit that won't allow anybody to claim more than $1,000. We build edits so around the processing. We also build edits around the fraud detection. And if a return hits an edit, it kicks it out of the automated. It suspends it, which is why we call it suspense. And so we measure, the numbers I have are measuring the difference between suspended and non-suspended returns. For non-suspended, so it just went right through, it didn't hit one of our rules or edits. It took 22 days this year to get a refund out the door. And these numbers are about refunds because we prioritize. We process refund returns first. If somebody says they owe and they send us a check, we bank the money and we set the return aside so we can get the refunds going. So 22 days for a non-suspended return. If you e-filed, it took 13. If you sent paper, it took 59 days this year. Suspended returns, average 59 days. E-filed 53, paper suspended returns were 84 days. So That compared to last year, it took us, I believe, it was 8 days for a non-suspended return, 17 days for a suspended return last year. And last year was a little bit of an anomaly because we purposely suspended fewer returns in anticipation of bringing on a new system. We wanted to have everything cleared out. We have a key performance measure that we report on annually, and every 2 years it ends up in our Ways and Means budget book. That key performance measure is set at 12 days to get a refund out the door. So we were 10 days slower than that this year. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the factors that go into that. And I have some non-system factors, and then I'll talk a little bit about the system factors I think influenced it. Non-system is... at the top of the list is fraud detection, and I've been in here before a couple of sessions talking about fraud and asking for money to help us get tools to enable our fraud detection. We are in the midst of that, and it's not unique to Oregon. Every state that has a personal income tax fights this, as does the federal government and the IRS, and we're all stepping it up. We have there's several groups formed with an alliance with the states. The IRS is helping lead this, that we're working with software companies that develop tax software to help us detect fraud with their information up front. We're also working with financial institutions to help us catch it on the back end, so if we miss it and a refund goes to what they think is a fraudulent account, they'll help us with that. So there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes, not just us, but other states. In fact, Utah, this year, they passed a law that says we won't issue a refund until March 1st because we want to build in time to do the fraud detection. And Louisiana did the same thing. They just didn't have it in statute like Utah did. The IRS, they've made several steps to kind of slow the process down. They've asked for changed the W-2 filing requirement for employers, where it was March 31st. This year, they moved it to January 31st. And with that, they said they wouldn't issue refunds that are based on W-2 information until February 15th. So give them time to get the information in the system to do their matching. They also said you have to have an ID number prior to filing, because for, every year, you could write applied for in the Social Security number box and saying you're working on getting a number, either a Social Security number or an I-10, a number that the IRS issues, and they would issue the refund. And this year they said, no, you got to have the number up front. So there's been some deliberate actions on our part, the federal part, on all the states' part, to slow down the process. And it's difficult because of the expectations that we've set in the past. For years we said, e-file, you'll get your refund in 10 days or less. We're trying to actually change some expectations because we have deliberately slowed down the process. This year, another factor in that is the kicker. The kicker in itself, we built edits around that. Not particularly a difficult computation. It was 5.6% of your tax before credits in 2014. But if you had a filing status change, you went from joint to single or vice versa, from 14 to 15, it complicated it. And that edit alone suspended thousands of returns. So those were kind of some non-system issues. Let's talk a little bit about the systems factors on our new system. Like I said, we rolled into Gentax. We did the personal income tax module and a few other ones in December of 2015, so it was fully functional for the processing season. And it came with the expected and unexpected issues that you get when you roll out a big system. We tested the heck out of it, and we missed something. Taxpayers are very creative, and we get very unusual situations. And how are we going to process that? And so we were scrambling. We had some returns that we couldn't process because we hadn't anticipated that situation, and we had to go back and do some reconfiguring. The new fraud module in itself. The rules we wrote around the fraud, and we had a pretty good idea what we wanted to look for, and we had done that manually in the past, but we wrote them into the system so the system could automatically do it, and we had no idea how many returns it would affect. The net was big. The net was wide. We pulled in over 200,000 returns into the fraud module. I didn't even have an exact number, but it was big. And we'll get better at that. But it wasn't a factor that slowed it down, because that meant that those folks that worked the fraud returns had thousands more they had to review this year. We also had a very steep learning curve. New system, it's very complicated. It does a lot of cool things, if I can use a technical term. It is very sophisticated. More steps for the user. We did a lot of training leading up to the season, and then we've continued to do ad hoc training throughout. But the learning curve was very steep, and we're way more comfortable in it now. We'll be better next year, but we're still learning it. Then we had a couple of issues on the process. Excuse me.
So on the 200,000 that you pulled in with the new criteria, if you will, how many of those were actual fraud, or how many just got sucked in because of something that you weren't anticipating?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Wissett, that's a very good question. We actually don't know the number yet, because we're sitting on what we think are fraud returns, and we're not clearing them out until we get through the extension period. But I think historically it were 10%, and that might be an inflated number, but it's a lot less than what we pulled in. Yeah.
Of course, a better question, that's not a good way to say it. No. A different question would be, what are your false negatives? And of course, you don't know the answer to that one.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct. We don't know that.
How many get past the fraud detection that are in fact fraudulent?
Correct. We don't know that, and I don't know that. Even though the system is way more sophisticated, I don't know that we'll be able to tell, as in our legacy system, if it was fraud and we sent the refund out the door. We only knew that if something happened on the back end. We got information from another state, or the refund got rejected or something. Once it's gone, it's gone.
Or the real taxpayer filed a return.
Filed a tax return, yeah. Correct. Yeah. Yes, which happened in a good majority of the cases.
Yeah.
Some of the new features within this tax system that we're learning, and we will refine over the next few years, of course, the fraud module. And it's a little bit of detail about that. We ask for money to buy the analytics that goes with it, and so we pull in big data, public data from Thomson Reuters, this system applies analytics, and it scores every return, whether it's a refund or a tax to pay, because we do get returns that say they owe that are fraudulent. It scores every return, puts on a scale of 1 to 100 or whatever, with 1 being absolutely legitimate. We know this is the real taxpayer, to 100 being absolutely fraudulent. Don't send that refund. To somewhere in the middle where we say, oh, we're not sure. So we do some work, and then we build a identity quiz to go along with this. So those in the middle, we would send a letter, say, hey, get online or call us and take our identity quiz. And we sent over 21,000 letters, I think, say, to folks that we just weren't quite sure. And the cool thing about the letter is it does a couple things. It lets people know that, yeah, we're looking at your return and your refund's going to be held up, so at least they know. And it also allows them to self-validate, so they can get online and pass this test, and it asks 5 questions. Some of it's around public data, like which address is correct for 1999 or something like that. And believe it or not, people fail those. But we do allow the option to send hard documentation. They can send proof of their identity.
You mean people who are even filing a legitimate tax return?
Yes.
Don't know where they lived in 1999.
Yes, okay. Even
if
that's
they
correct.
Still live there.
I'm not sure if we saw that. But, The other thing about this system is it we're networked with the other Gentex states. And there's over 30 Gentex states. Not all of them are using the fraud module, but we still can connect with them. And, for example, we can enter – if we have particulars from a fraudulent return, we can enter that into the system, and the other states can pick that up and use it as they wish. If they want to stop – if they get those particulars shown up in their system, they can stop those returns. So the network is actually a very good thing. We also have the ability to do more matching, and we're going to build on that. We started out kind of slow to, as we're learning it, but for example, one of the matching tools that we have now is we changed our form, and if you actually are familiar with our form, we went from 2 pages to 4 pages this year because we are collecting more information, and some of that is we're collecting dependent information, so now we have the ability to tell when a dependent is claimed on more than one tax return. That's the kind of matching that we can do. We also have a tax credit module that we have the ability to get the information from the certifying agency that we can enter that in, so we can get an amount from the energy, for example, and of the credit that was awarded, we can match that on the tax return, and if it's more or less, if it's more than what energy said, we can adjust it. If it's less, we know what is available for carryover to the next year. So we'll be able to track credits as we get them built in there. And this year we only had two of them. The rural medical was one of them. I can't remember the, but we'll be able to track. And at any given time, if it's a certified credit, we'll know what's been claimed and what the state's still on the hook for being carried forward. It has a discovery tool that we'll mainly use this in audit situation to help us create better audit leads, but we're also going to, as we get smarter, use it in tandem with processing so that we can tailor our edits differently. For example, this year we told folks that if you were amending your 2014 tax year, don't also amend your 2015 to change your kicker amount, because we could do that through this discovery tool. And so in the last month, we've sent 6,000 notices or checks to folks that amended their 2014. We wrote a little program that said if the tax was 14 tax was changed after we processed the 15 return, then make that adjustment. Either send them a bill because they owed more, or send them a check because they owed less. We also have some automation that comes with this system. The one example I want to give of that is on the filing enforcement, the work we do around strongly encouraging people to file. These are probably the involuntary people where we think they should have filed, but we didn't get a return from them. The system has automated that, can take federal information and automatically generate a tax and a billing and send it out. The good thing about that, besides automating, is we've been able to take those people resources and shift them to help us on the processing side.
Does that include returns where you expect that you would be making a refund, like a refundable credit of some kind, for example?
Chair Barnhart, no. We don't include, if it has a refundable credit, we don't include that. We don't anticipate or assume that we know what it should be for them.
But so you're only dealing with ones where you think that the taxpayer owes you money.
That's correct.
I have a question.
Yes, what's it?
And I don't think this is what we've talked about yet, but this is just a question I have. Does the kicker, someone else in my family handles taxes, so does the kicker come as a separate check, or does it come with a refund if you're expecting a refund from the Department of Revenue?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt. So the kicker was on the a refundable credit on the 2015 return. So if you filed filed your 15 return, it would have automatically been included. If you amended your 2014, which is the tax year that the kicker is calculated from, then and it so it would have changed your kicker amount, then you would end up getting a check or a notice if you owed more. But if you filed it, if everything is lined, if you filed your 14 and like you should have, and then your 15, it should have just been part of the tax return.
Okay, so it's one check,
right?
Then it's all okay.
It ends up netting out, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay. I mean, if you owe money on your all other items, and the kicker credit is less than that amount, you just owe less.
That's.
And if the kicker credit is larger than that amount, then you send a refund check.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And if you didn't owe at all, like say you didn't have a filing requirement, but you had tax in 2014, you had to file a tax return in order to get your kicker and to get your refund, because it is a refundable credit.
So I have a question.
Yes, please,
on
yes.
The earned income tax, EITs.
Right. Yeah, that was really what I was asking about earlier, but go ahead, yeah.
Okay, all right. Did he answer that?
I'm not sure that you have the same question or not. So
okay, well, no, I was just wondering if everybody gets a kicker that would get an earned income tax, or the EITs, if they automatically get the kicker with that. If they didn't pay taxes, there's a class of people that don't pay taxes, but get tax money refund from the state because their income level. So, do they get the kicker also?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, the kicker is not. It's determined on whether based on your 2014 tax. So, if you had a tax before credits in 2014. You're going to get a kicker. If you didn't, regardless of if you had an earned income credit or not,
okay.
It's all about net tax. So tax before credits in 2014.
Ah.
And it was 5.6% of that tax before credits.
Right. Yeah. So in other words, see if you agree with this.
Okay.
If a taxpayer owes $100, before credits, then we give them an EITC, and they get a net check from you for $50. I'm making up numbers here. In 14, you're going to calculate their kicker credit on that $100 that was the amount of their tax before the EITC credit.
That's correct.
So they would get some. They would get $5.60 or whatever
cents,
it is
yes.
For their kicker credit, in addition to whatever the EITC might produce for them in 15.
Chair Barnhart, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I did not know that, and I've learned something.
Okay, thank you. So just one more thing on the new features, not necessarily about Gentax itself, but we built a new, they build a online tool that integrates with Gentax that has features that it allows you to view all your account balances, make payments, request a waiver or an appeal. You can do that online. It has a secure chat feature. So if you're, heaven forbid, working with an auditor and you want to send information back and forth, there's a secure feature in this online function to do that. It also has more options to file electronically, not personal income tax, because we use the modernized e-file platform through the IRS for personal income tax, but other tax programs such as 911 and marijuana have set up an online filing for their quarterly returns. So looking forward to 2017. Like I said, we fully anticipate to start in a much better position. We are evaluating and refining our business rules, both around the fraud module and the regular tax the processing of the tax return. We're doing that right now so we can get the programming done. We're doing more cross-training. We're shifting resources. We also are with the Rollout 3, which brings on the next big program, which is withholding. We upgrade to version 10 of Gentax. There's not a whole lot of difference in the Gentax itself. There's some enhanced user on our side features that are going to make it easier to use. On the external, though, the online portion, that will be totally revamped, have a new look and feel. It gives us more features that we're getting driving to more where we're more self-service, much like the banks or the financial institution. We're trying to get more of that because of the expectation is out there that people have that ability.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Senator Riley.
When you talk about upgrade to the new version, and you have made modifications and edits to the old version, do those have to be reapplied?
Representative Barnhart, Senator Riley, if it's outside of, we will have to do some of that. Some of the stuff that is specific to Oregon, we will have to reconfigure for the new version. Yes. And finally, the last thing I want to talk about is I talked about matching, and we're going to do more of that in 2017. We asked for money in 2015 to give to employment to reprogram their system so that we can get quarterly wage and withholding information that they get from the employers. They can send that to us. So we're getting that quarterly now. We will use that in addition to the W-2 information that we get, the annual reconciliation. We will use that for matching as we process tax returns. And we're also planning to expand the number of credits that go into the tax credit module. We have a legislative concept, a little heads up here, that we hope gets heard in the 17th session, that we're asking to do some language cleanup around the tax credits, and not the credit itself, but the administration of it, to get every credit, if it has transferability, that it has, they all have the same kind of language on how that's done and how the information gets reported to us. We've reached out to the agencies that have that certify credits to give them a heads up, and they said, hey, why don't we start on this now? They were all excited about it. So we're already working on interfaces with, like, energy to get that, be able to get that tax certification number electronically in 17, so we can add it to our module and we can better track the tax credits.
Chair Hass.
Thank you for this update. It's very informative. I remember some years ago we had a discussion when there were some problems, and it was that the IRS found a problem with fraud and that wasn't communicated to the state, or vice versa, and it would seem if somebody's cheating the IRS, they were at least suspect in Oregon. So is that built into this now, where those cross channels are?
Chair House, yes. As a matter of fact, that alliance that we have built, the states are building with the IRS, we are exchanging information daily with the IRS. So if they've got fraudulent information, they're sending it to the states, and we're able to put that in our system.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. And about fraud, I've been on this committee for a while, and quite often you've asked us for more money for fraud inspectors. And I'm wondering, with the new software, and is that requiring more fraud inspectors because you have more fraud kickouts, or less, or is it about the same?
Chair Barnhart, Senator Riley, at this point, we're not looking to add significantly more people to that side. We're hoping that the system can, we can make the system smart enough to do a lot of that work that we've done manually. Oregon isn't to the point yet where we think we need more, like states like Georgia and Louisiana, the southern states. They have criminal investigative units, mm-hmm. Where they actually have a group that's dedicated to the pursuit of criminal activity and prosecution. We're not to that point yet. So I guess the bottom line to answer your question is, right now we're looking for the system to help us do a lot of that work.
Thank you. Chair Hass asked a question about your communications with the IRS. Earlier you mentioned that you're exchanging information with other states when you have a suspected fraud case. Do they also give you information when they have one, and when you send them something and they also have a return that comes from what appeared to be the same person, do they let you know about that?
Chair Barnhart, yes. We are part of a group through the Federal Tax Administration Suspicious Filer Exchange. So we, on daily, we are receiving through email, but they've just set up a secured method to exchange information from the states, where we'll get return particulars that we can enter ourselves. the part of the fraud module, the where the other states are also have that, the Gentex states, we can enter it into the system and they can pick it up that way. We do sometimes we get reports on, if we send information, we get reports back. Some of the states will report back, oh, we didn't see that in our state, or yes, we had saw this. It's become very important because of all the activity and the, I don't know if you, you know, it's in our forefront all the time, but this year was the year of the employer breaches, the phishing scams, where somebody sends an email to the HR director and say, give me all your employee information, and they say, oh, okay. And yeah, so there was a lot of that happened this year. They're also being sophisticated enough to hack into tax professionals' systems and just pull tax return information right from the system. So it's important to be more diligent than ever.
It's important. It wasn't guns or bootlegging or violence that brought down Al Capone. It was tax evasion.
Yeah, it's true. That's right. Yeah, and I'm assuming when you and Missouri or you and Louisiana have a same Social Security number claiming residency in that state, you've got a pretty good idea that at least one of those returns is false.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct.
Probably both.
Other questions? I have just one, I think, additional one. Recognizing that no system is ever perfect, how many more years do you think it will take you to get this one kind of scoped in? To the point where you're making relatively small changes in years after that?
Chair Barnhart, that's a good question. Based on what we've heard and seen from other states, it's a 3 to 5 year process probably to get it totally. I don't know that we can ever totally get it there, but to get it refined to the point I think you're talking about.
Sounds like revenue bills.
Absolutely.
Takes 3 to 5 years to get it right.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you.
Senator Hass, announcements? Okay, you're meeting next week?
The Senate committee meets at 8 o'clock next Wednesday.
Wednesday, okay. And we're meeting at
2 o'clock.
2 on Wednesday. We're going to be talking about housing issues primarily, but I think it'll be an enlightening session, so we hope everybody is able to come. Anything else for the good of the order? And notice that our presenters were so efficient today that we get 15 minutes back for other uses. And with that, the House Interim Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
And we are adjourned.